Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a long-standing journalist of food, health, and the environment, its policy, its science, its practical application to you, and I report on this here on Connect the Dots on Progressive Radio Network, as well as on Alternet, EcoWatch, TruthDig, and upcoming some pieces in some other outlets as well. As regular listeners know, I've been covering the trade deals almost for the entire year. We do other programs, but by far the greatest weight of the coverage on this program this year has been TPP, Fast Track, which is moving that into position to be passed, and the other related trade deals. If all of these topics are new to you, we'll provide some introduction on today's program, and you can also go into the Connect the Dots archive when, you know, beginning in actually May of 2014 and then coming back pretty strongly late in January of 2015 and all the way through June and throughout the year. I've been talking with today's guests as well as other experts about these trade deals, which have a large, looming, and far-reaching effect on all the topics that, you know, I've been covering on Connect the Dots since being on the air over the last 5 years. And that has to do with all the things that go on in our world that are that protect or harm our personal health and well-being and that of our families, our communities, our society, and the planet Earth. And that's what we discuss every week on this show. So today's guest, I'm delighted to welcome back William Warren. He's been on the show many times and has really long been a guiding light for our understanding of these trade deals, my own and that of many other people. And he has been writing and analyzing and all the rest of it. He's a trade policy analyst for Friends of the Earth, who works to protect the environment from the negative impact of international trade and investment agreements, contributing to the policy discussions about trade and environmental issues across a whole range of forums. Prior to joining Friends of the Earth, he worked at the Forum on Democracy and Trade, and he's been a policy analyst literally for decades with a specialty in this area. So in this time when trade deals have come into prominence to really step far beyond what any of us would have defined as or imagined to be a trade deal into a real overarching authority over many choices about health, food, and the environment that should be left in the hands of local or national government, but which are now being manipulated and overseen through these deals by international corporations. People who care about health on all levels are very fortunate that there's a longstanding expert that really understands the complexity of what we might otherwise fail to understand and ignore to our great harm. So it's great to welcome you back again to Connect the Dots, Bill Warren. Thanks for being with us yet again.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Now, today, we're going to do a little backup background just for any new listeners who might be new to this issue. You know, usually when I talk to people about it, there are a lot of people who don't really know what I'm talking about. More and more people are aware of it. And usually the thing that people are aware of is the term TPP. They're aware of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the first, you know, it's kind of the big brother of the deals that's kind of heading down toward us. And it's something that's been negotiated over a number of years and that has all kinds of provisions that will affect key areas that we take for granted in public life and all of that. But it's not the only trade deal that is in the offing. Bill, could you give our listeners a kind of orientation to the different deals, the order at which they're arriving, and you know, kind of what makes one different from another, you know, and then we can later talk about what the combined impact of all of these might be.
Well, sure. There are three major trade deals in play right at the moment. You mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and those negotiations have concluded, and it's expected that Congress may take a vote in 2016 in the upcoming congressional session up to the first of the year. In addition to that, there are two other deals that are in the negotiation stage at this point. The first that's gotten a bit more publicity is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or the TTIP, which is an agreement between the United States and the European Union, which of course includes, I think, something like 22 countries. And the third has been the most secret of them all. It's called the Trade in Services Agreement, which is an attempt for the United States and the European Union to get changes in the whole global trading system that they've been unable to get at the World Trade Organization. And it focuses on services, but that's a trade law definition of services that affects a whole range of environmental, climate, health, food safety policies. But the thing to understand about all three of these agreements is that they're not primarily about trade in any common sense definition. They only deal peripherally or secondarily with tariffs and market access and at the border inspections, those sorts of things. Rather, they're branded as trade deals because the focus groups show that there's a general public approval of trade among nations, and as well there should be, because it's often a way to bind people together in a way that better ensures peaceful coexistence. But that's just really a label, a branding exercise. What they're really intended to do is to roll back government regulations, to deregulate, to get rid of or water down those safeguards that we have for the environment and food safety, public health, and climate. And it's a really, really dangerous situation that we're in, because what we will find if these agreements are negotiated and then ratified by Congress, that our democratic institutions, our Congress, our state legislatures, our city councils, all the various governmental regulatory agencies related to the environment and health, will be handcuffed and restricted in their capacity to protect the public and to protect the planet. And it's really what some scholars have called a constitution for the world economy, meaning that just like our constitution limits the capacity of government to interfere with free speech, these agreements limit the capacity of government to protect the public health, to protect the environment, to protect the climate, to protect food safety.
And yet we hear so little about that. We hear that we need this for China. We hear that we need it for the economy. It's the fact that, they're presented to the public as if this were not even on the agenda and it had nothing to do with the things that you're describing. Now, let me ask you, is this obviously, the focus of Friends of the Earth is on the environmental and other impacts that we're discussing. That's my focus as a reporter. It's probably the interest and the focus of most people listening to this program. But then we go out and talk to other people, and it's like apples and oranges, because they hear the treaties are entirely about something else. Would you say that as a byproduct of their control or exercise to control a whole lot of matters to our society, that these treaties as a minor byproduct limit our ability to mitigate for health, the environment, safety, and all the rest of it? Or is it in fact their true purpose to do that, and they're just kind of traveling under false cover? Or is there a different proportion? Is maybe 40% of this negatively impacting the areas we're talking about, and then there's another 60% that's off doing something else. I mean, I know I've never asked you that question before, because we share these concerns about these primordially important areas that really govern not only life on Earth and the future of human life on Earth, you know, for many generations. So for people of our values, you know, that's the number one thing. But is it actually a by accident that they're knocking this in the treaties, or is that really really a significant part of what the treaties are there to do? I know that's kind of a strange judgment call, but, you know.
It's not just a significant part. It's the central purpose of these agreements. And there is a rationale for why deregulation and also the privatization of government services is central. And that is, these agreements are based on the theory that was really first popularized and implemented by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. In other words, that government is the problem. And in order to get the economic growth that we need, we need to shrink government and get government out of the way. And let the free market bring prosperity to all of us. It's a form of market fundamentalism. So their rationale, their argument is, well, this is about trade and economic growth, because what's inhibiting trade and what's inhibiting economic growth are all these darn environmental regulations, all these public health regulations. You know, the market will correct itself from their point of view.
Well, certainly the ideas that you're mentioning and, you know, that value set and all of that is one with which anyone who ever follows the news in any to any degree whatsoever would be, you know, incredibly cognizant of. I mean, you know, this is like what's out there in terms of the group that is, you know, kind of rendering Congress useless and taking over as elected officials in our world, and the whole threat to democracy that we are, you know, witnessing in our time is promulgated by those who share the values that you mentioned and the goals that you mentioned. So what you're saying, what that tells us then, is these treaties constitute a further advancement of that same agenda. They're
That's
taking
exactly
that same
right.
agenda
That's exactly
further.
Right. Yep. And be aware that these agreements are written under the close supervision, almost, of the corporations, the global corporations that are affected by government regulations, and particularly by Wall Street. Indeed, the U.S. Trade Representative, our chief negotiator, came from Citibank, and like a lot of other chief negotiators for trade deals in the past, Michael Froman has been through this revolving door more than once between negotiating, making national economic policy, negotiating trade agreements, and then returning to Wall Street or a corporate boardroom to make millions as a result of the changes in public policy. And it's also tied to our campaign finance system. Michael Froman was a major fundraiser for the 2008 Barack Obama presidential campaign. His predecessors, Ron Kirk and Mickey Cantor, were also major campaign organizers, campaign donation organizers for other Democratic presidents, and both also worked for Wall Street and major polluting organizations. Mickey Cantor, who's the fellow who pushed the NAFTA and the World Trade Organization deals through, left to go into the private practice of law, and he sat on the boards of companies like Monsanto and advised the Biotechnology Council and so forth and so on. So, and furthermore, these agreements are closely developed with official trade advisory committees that are overwhelmingly composed of the representatives of the major corporations, so that they're actually, if not exactly in the room, providing most of the policy analysis and legal drafting that goes into the deals. And the public is kept totally in the dark. It's, these agreements are totally secret until they're done. And the corporate insiders, the Wall Street folks, the fossil fuel companies, they're at the table.
Mm-hmm. So what you're providing is the entire context for how this is happening and who's doing it and what their goals are. So while all of the fine points of what they're actually doing and what the treaties will do and how they will change our ability to protect health, food, and the environment, and our own lives, and our own democracy, indeed, will be fundamentally changed by these deals in specific ways that were unknown last year, when or earlier in this year, when you know the fast track vote, the vote to allow the president to sign them with a very abbreviated review process by Congress, which was the mechanism put in place last spring. While that was being, you know, prepared and kind of argued about, because once you allow that, then your ability to review what is in these treaties is, you know, it's limited because you've already granted a certain measure of authority on a certain very rushed time frame. That's already happened. And at that time, a lot of the details were unknown. And so many people were kind of saying, we don't know, we can't know, we couldn't possibly know. Until we see them, we don't know. But then there's this setup where by the time you see them, it's a much harder battle to fight. And, you know, thankfully, through growing public awareness, that battle is being fought, nevertheless. But at that time, you know, apart from some few leaks, the information, the specific mechanisms were unknown, so that we couldn't point to them and say, this says this, and that can be interpreted in such a way that this is going to be the outcome, you know. And so people were like, well, we just don't know, and you know, but because we didn't have the hard information. Now the treaty texts are being released. They're being leaked more, and we do know more. What does, like, let's kind of go to what the most recent revelations, as we're talking today, you know, have revealed.
Well, you're right. Actually, the Trans-Pacific Partnership text has been released. The fast track law requires that it be released once the negotiations are complete, and we're still studying that. It's over 6,000 pages long and written in dense legalese and very craftily written to hide its intent, but we're developing a complete analysis of the final text of the TPP. In the meantime, we're relying on leaks, and in particular WikiLeaks. And indeed, a few weeks ago, I was contacted by WikiLeaks and indicated that they were going to get an important section of the trade and services agreement that I mentioned earlier, and they wanted me to analyze that. And that's what I've recently done. And a few days ago, we published that leaked text with my analysis that came out under our name and our, through our outlet and as well, and at WikiLeaks in London as well. And now it's circulating around the globe. So thanks to insiders who are disillusioned and appalled by this process in the same way we are, they put their careers and actually their personal safety and their freedom from criminal prosecution at risk by leaking these documents. And we do have a basis for making very concrete criticisms of the effect that these agreements, in this case the TISA, or Trade and Services Agreement, will have on the environment and the climate.
Mm-hmm. And what are those effects? I mean, what does the leaked material, according to your analysis, reveal?
Well, the document that I have is an annex on environmental services to the Trade and Services Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really going to have a major impact on climate and a whole range of public health and environmental safeguards. In particular, I think the climate, and this is ironic because right now the whole world is watching as leaders from all over the globe, almost every country, are converged on Paris for the big climate summit.
Mm-hmm.
To make non-binding commitments to reduce carbon emissions and save the planet and save the human race from being cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the irony is that at the same time, in total secrecy, Michael Froman and the other trade negotiators are meeting secretly in Geneva to make further progress in finalizing the Trade and Services Agreement. And there's no publicity about that. And it's truly ironic because the TISA agreement will be binding. The climate agreement will not be binding in all likelihood. And so the TISA agreement, the TPP, and the TTIP will trump whatever commitment is made in Paris. And this is largely something that is not covered by the U.S. press and only limited coverage in the global press.
Mm-hmm. It's, it's funny because it's not funny, but I was thinking about the show, in our conversation today, and, the words, the word that came up for me as well was this trumps, and we say this as we have this so-called candidate, in our presidential thing, but this is going on. And the astounding thing, and this has been true, from very early on, is that, and we've had conversations, dating back a while about the fact that the coverage has been so incredibly limited. Of course, now there has been more. Bill Moyers is weighing in, and other people are weighing in, and it's actually kind of really the press coverage has greatly increased in the independent media and among independent voices. So the information is certainly out there for listeners. Beyond this show, if you Google any of this, you will find it, but you won't find it very much in the major outlets like New York Times or Television News or anything like that. It's basically, even on MSNBC, with the departure of Ed Schultz, who was the only on-air anchor who was covering it, it's basically not there, even in the so-called liberal media. You won't find much about it. And, I just want, for anyone who is unfamiliar with the legal term, I just want to reiterate what you just said. You said that the climate agreements that are receiving all this coverage and everyone is going, yay, hooray, and we have placed such high hopes on this, is non-binding, but the treaty agreements are binding. You just said that. Can you explain just to anyone who may be unfamiliar with these legal terms what the difference is?
Well, the distinction is that the TPP, the TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement will be enforced by international a system of international tribunals that is, in essence, a global judicial system for major corporations and investors, wealthy investors exclusively. And these tribunals, which are staffed by corporate trade lawyers, mainly from Wall Street and the City of London, are members of these three-person tribunals are almost all folks who come right out of the corporate law sector. And in the case of investment tribunals, they are actually appointed on an ad hoc basis so that one day they may be representing Monsanto in an investment tribunal case, and the next day they may be sitting as in effect judge on an issue where Monsanto or Chevron has a concern. So these are biased tribunals, and unlike most international treaties and most international tribunal decisions, they are enforceable. The investment chapters of these agreements allow the assessment against the public budget of money damages that can run into the millions or even billions of dollars in compensation to the corporations and to the wealthy investors for their lost current and future profits as a result of having to obey environmental, public health, and climate regulations. And in the case of the TISA agreement, and as well as the TPP and TTIP agreements, we also have regular trade tribunals that can assess or that can authorize the country which that brings the suit. This is a state-to-state, government-to-government adjudication. It would allow the plaintiff government to, if the defendant government loses and does not comply, would allow the plaintiff government to apply retaliatory trade sanctions such as higher tariffs on goods or services coming from the defendant country, or they could even withdraw the intellectual property rights like copyright and trademark protections for firms based in the losing defendant country. So in contrast to the climate agreement, which is aspirational and depends upon the voluntary compliance of the parties, there's nothing voluntary in the compliance process for these trade and investment deals. They are effectively enforced.
Wow. So, I mean, I'm going to ask you a little bit of a tough question here. You know, I mean, it's really cognitively dissonant to see so many sectors of the, you know, environmental community, you know, marching and celebrating, and, you know, we're marching in support of what's going on in Paris, you know, with this kind of tilted playing field embedded in the entire, you know, at the very structure of this. I mean, how are we, what exactly are we supposed to be celebrating under the circumstances?
Well, we're not celebrating everything in Paris because we're very concerned that it's not going to be binding and it will not result in the changes in public policy and the reductions of emissions that are absolutely necessary. In the meantime, I should also say it's not just Friends of the Earth. It's almost every major environmental organization in the United States and around the world that's fighting tooth and nail to stop these three pending trade and investment agreements. Mm-hmm. And we are creating a mass movement around the globe of people and grassroots organizations to resist this and to put pressure on governments to back away. And even though we lost that vote on the fast-track bill by the narrowest of margins, just a handful of votes, we have a very good chance of stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal in Congress because some of the people who voted for fast-track have already said that they're not voting for the Trans-Pacific Partnership now that they've seen the details. Mm-hmm. And with the leak of the Trade and Services Agreements documents that we studied, we see increasing opposition in legislative bodies around the globe to the TISA agreement. So it's not hopeless. People can make a difference if they organize and they hold their public officials accountable. And despite the odds and the lack of press coverage and the money in politics, we can win this fight, and we will.
I mean, there has been an enormous upsurge in awareness, and I would imagine as well, you know, is there good leverage in other countries where people are looking at this and saying, you know, what is this? We don't want to be doing this? I mean, you know, where would you say the stiffest opposition to the treaties is coming from globally?
Well, with respect to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, we're seeing a lot of resistance in Malaysia, for example. And there is a reasonable possibility that Malaysia will pull out of the deal. And I think that, as I said before, I think there's a, I think we've got a 50-50 chance or a little bit better to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal here in the United States. With respect to the U.S.-European Union deal, the TTIP, there is enormous opposition among the European public and among European elected officials, particularly in the parliaments, as opposed to the people who sit on the European Commission in Paris, who are basically technocrats who are unaccountable. So we're building a mass movement around the world that's making a difference. And now with the revelations of the really frightening provisions in the Trade and Services Agreement, thanks to WikiLeaks, you know, we're heightening awareness around the globe on this, and we are seeing, again, particularly in Europe, a gigantic movement in opposition. And I mean, there were something like 50,000 people in the streets protesting these trade deals in Berlin just a few months ago, and you know, mass rallies of thousands and thousands of people across the continent. And furthermore, the press is not as corporate controlled and Wall Street controlled in Europe as it is elsewhere. I've done extensive interviews, for example, with Le Monde, which is sort of the French equivalent of the New York Times. You know, it's it's different than the New York Times. It's not encyclopedic, but it's a, you know, a very high quality publication that you know, that is sort of the great authority in the press. And they've covered, you know, I've had interviews with Le Monde, and they've extensively covered this secretive trade and services agreement. And so we're making progress in it. And if we can't stop it here, I think we will. But if we can't stop it here, I think we can stop these deals by working with our allies overseas. And we've stopped really nasty trade and investment agreements in the past in just that way. We stopped the so-called free trade area of the Americas, which have covered the whole Western Hemisphere, so, you know, South and North America both. And you know, I worked very closely with governments in South America and in Canada, and particularly led by Brazil. Those negotiations were scuttled. And in the same way, a few years ago, there was something called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which would have been a global investment agreement, a global investment court system of the time, kind I described, that would cover the globe. And that was scuttled largely because of European and French opposition in particular. And I will say the French are like apparently in the lead once again in questioning the TTIP, or the US-EU agreement. And I hope now that we have revelations that we can, you know, work with our international partners to stop the TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement.
What are the specific areas that, for example, the French, you know, question about these treaties and what their effect would be?
Well, I think a lot of the opposition is focused on the democracy problems and the way in which an independent court system is subverted by a corporate-controlled kangaroo court, if you will. And that was a central, I mean, that was the French objection to the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, is that they, you know, take pride in their democracy. I mean, they were the second country since ancient times after the United States of America to establish a democracy, and they take great pride in the independence of their court system and the, you know, the Code Napoleon and so forth. And so it's a matter of national sovereignty and national pride, as well as just common sense. And and the French are not beyond making waves when they're upset, as we all know. And so they're just the kind of people we need to be talking to. And are talking to.
If these treaties were allowed to go forward, I mean, basically that would, you know, I mean, would that rapidly accelerate climate change in terms of, you know, would this take the rising, you know, temperatures, you know, would it accelerate that past a point when, you know, take it just completely out of the box for us here?
Well, absolutely. And it's very clear that the fossil fuel companies see these trade investment deals as the way to defeat our keep it in the ground movement, because they have investments that are worth billions and billions of dollars, and you know, and they get and people buy their stocks because these investments are seen as a source of massive future profitability, and if they're unable to mine the coal and pump the oil and gas because of climate regulations, or if the market for those fossil fuels declines, then this massive wealth that they've created and the expected future profits that are out there, you know, will disappear. And so they are counting on these agreements and they're counting on these trade and investment tribunals to protect their investment expectations, or they expect in the alternative to be paid billions of dollars for the regulatory actions that don't allow them to, that force them to keep it in the ground. So this is very closely tied. And if we don't keep it in the ground, we're going to bake the planet and threaten the human race.
So it's really, you know, their financial interests, you know, against, I mean, this is nothing new, of course, but this is reaching a kind of peak, you know, pitch point with all of this. How aware do you think that environmentally concerned public, you know, not the climate deniers, not the people who, I don't know what's happening, you know, I don't know what's going on here, but, you know, the people who would be, who are environmentally concerned, how concerned are they and how cognizant are they of the threat posed by these trade deals, would you say?
Well, I think among environmental activists, the familiarity with these deals is extensive. But then there's the larger public support for the environmental movement among people who, you know, are not working, you know, as volunteers or as activists on a daily or frequent basis. And those people are increasingly being informed through alternative media and through our organizations, environmental organizations' outreach to people who are concerned. But we, you know, we need to keep working at it because we don't have a Le Monde in the United States, you know, a major newspaper that's indicting these agreements. So we have to do it the we have to win the old-fashioned way of community organizing and talking to our neighbors and comrades, and then in the new-fashioned way through social media and electronic publications, and we're getting the message out. I mean, it's people like you who are getting the message out, and we greatly appreciate it. It's the most important public service.
Well, thank you. You know, I go around and, you know, I bring it up to people. I bring it up to my personal friends. I bring it up to people I work with. I kind of mention it. You know, of course, there's a certain group of people that I work with who are, you know all about it, and they're informing me as well, you know. So, but there are some people that, you know, I know quite a few people, and I'm sure everyone listening does too, I'm sure you do, who, you know, don't really know much about it. And I often find when I kind of bring it up, there can be ignorance, or there can also be like, oh, we shouldn't think about that, and I don't want to mention that, and you know, I mention this because, you know, you don't want to kind of alienate people by, you know, kind of lecturing to them, but it's also important not to let the wish for denial or the ignorance to just, you know, be kind of considered the norm. Oh, well, we'll just, you know, be in denial. That's good. That's okay. That's what everyone does. Well, let's go along with that, you know. So I countered that by bringing it up to a certain extent, even when it's uncomfortable for those, you know, to whom I'm speaking. And, you know, I don't like to, you know, and it's hard because you kind of don't want to force ideas on people who are unwilling to hear it or don't want to hear it or something. But I think we have to do a little bit of that and kind of figure out for ourselves where the line is. I know that as an expert, you're probably, you know, talking to people who, you know, are ready to be hearing about that, although you may encounter others who aren't. I mean, any thoughts about, like, what people who would like to spread the word can do?
Well, I think that we have to be patient and persistent, and we have to communicate to different people in ways that are appropriate for them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be persistent because there's a normal human reaction of just not accepting. You know, getting your head, it's hard to get your head around something with such a gigantic threat.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like we're hardwired not to process that kind of information. That's one of the problems that we've had with climate deniers among the public, because the threat is so huge that people initially feel powerless and reject the idea that it could possibly be true, even though there's a 99% scientific consensus that says that it's true and it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, well, we see it in the refugee issues that are going on in the world today. People's hearts go out when hearts went out when they saw the little Syrian boy who drowned on the beach in Turkey. And
mm-hmm.
and they demanded action to, you know, take care of that little boy. But then they get statistics that there are literally millions of people in that little boy's situation of being, you know, forced to flee a conflict zone. You know, they can't get their heads around it, and they deny that that it's happening. That can't be true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a rational reaction, but it's a human reaction. And we just need to keep communicating, and we need to be thoughtful in the
mm-hmm.
way that we talk to people who are in denial. It's
mm-hmm.
not useful to be self-righteous or lecturing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to talk to people in a very human way about why they should pay attention to this, and not in a preachy way.
Mhm. Yeah. That's, you know, it's funny. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is, you know, sometimes we're all taught, as you say, we're all wired, you know, to be focused on short-term concerns. I mean, this is how we manage. It's how we manage life. You know, but so, you know, we spend a lot of our time and energy taking care of, you know, short-term concerns, short-term personal concerns. And then there are these big looming things, you know, that will just make them, you know, could potentially make them all irrelevant. And we just, you know, are just kind of in this stunned situation where, you know, we don't really, you know exactly how to deal with it. And yet it kind of, you know, relates to almost everything. I mean, it's just such a, you know, such a strange kind of thing. And very worrying, too, very worrying. And, you know, let me ask you another question, because what often comes up, I find, among people who are less acquainted with this overall, is they'll, you know, we have the president, for example, saying, you know, it's short-sighted and we must, you know, do something about this. And yet, you know, he's the one who's also been pushing for the trade deals. And that's also cognitively dissonant. I mean, you know, how can people get their minds around this when, you know, they're public, you know, there's conflicting behavior from leaders.
Well, that's right. And I mean, the problem here fundamentally is money and politics, and the revolving door between Wall Street and the revolving door of corporate lobbyists into government service. And Barack Obama had to raise, I think it's close to $1 billion twice.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain compromises that come with raising the money that it takes to win a successful campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Froman, who's an old friend of Barack Obama's, they were in law school together, both served on the Harvard Law Review, and I understand that Mike Froman may have been one of the people who had a very significant level of responsibility in seeing Barack Obama elected the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. He became a famous man as a young law student, the first time that a black man had had such a prestigious, that very, very prestigious position.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's close personal ties there, and sometimes we saw this with Harry Truman and Ulysses Grant and other presidents who were generally good presidents, but who had old relationships that they were often blind to what was going on among people who had been lifelong friends. And I mean,
mm-hmm.
The unpleasant word for this is cronies and
mm-hmm.
crony politics. Someone who is a close personal friend of a powerful person, like the President of the United States, and gets favors. And,
mm-hmm.
and again, this is even a man mm-hmm. as rational and intelligent as Barack Obama is subject to a certain amount of emotional thinking. And
mm-hmm.
I don't think he can get his head around the idea that his old friend may be misrepresenting things to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in the same way that Harry Truman couldn't believe that some of his old cronies were, you know, had their hand in the public till.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's again, it's human nature, and we'll just have. That's the only way I can explain Barack Obama
mm-hmm.
Dissonance on these issues, because
mm-hmm.
his own legacy will be compromised by these trade deals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't think he can get his head around that.
It's too much
for him to accept, just like it's too much for people to accept climate change.
You know, I find that very helpful because, you know, many people also, in the same way that you describe with Barack Obama, having a sense of loyalty and liking for an old friend that may be interfering with his ability to see the greater impact of these things and the conflict between them and the other things that he, you know, is taking a stand for. You know, that's confusing stuff, and I think just as he feels that, many Americans feel the same about him. You know, they feel that, he's been good. He's been the best that we could have had under the circumstances. There's a sense of loyalty. You know, and then how could this be happening? It must either be not as bad as we think because, you know, this is what he's recommending, or, and then other people who are cynical about him or even hate him, you know, express anger or hatred toward him because of this, the detrimental nature of these treaties and the betrayal of people's perception of what the president is about and stands for and all. So it's kind of like we're all having that problem. And the reason that I'm asking you about this, I mean, you're a trade expert, and you know your analysis of what the import of these treaties is really your expertise. But in terms of expanding the conversation, so that other people who are not, you know, haven't been following this that closely, can also come to see the problem and get past their own confusion, you know, about the president standing up one day for this while, you know, his administration, you know, high-level administration officials are countermanding it, you know, in the same moments on the same trip, you know. It could lead to a deep sense of disappointment, cynicism, despair over, you know, how, you know, it feels very disempowering. I mean, you know, we don't know how we can have a voice in all of this. And when we see this level of confusion, it's very natural for people to want to discount one side or the other or to withdraw, you know. So yeah. I feel these conversations are really important and germane to the whole topic.
That's almost the human tragedy of denial of things that we don't want to deal with. I mean, Shakespeare wrote a lot about that, King Lear and so forth. You know, just even the brightest and most capable people can have difficulty facing a difficult truth.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah, I mean, the Vice President Gore's calling his film an inconvenient truth, you know, is, you know, it really nails that problem. And I'm always kind of, I mean, he really, in a very mass level, launched, you know, this conversation in the minds of many people through that film. And also took a lot of heat as a kind of, he's become, you know, the reviled punching bag for the climate deniers, you know, part of this kind of absurd accusation or concern that the climate problem is an agenda, a champion for a political reason of some kind, but I guess that's the best they could do but it seems to have worked with some people as a counter argument to their own climate denial. Like, why, you know, Mark Ruffalo said something. He was, I don't know if you or our listeners have seen this, but recently he was in a green room. He happened to find himself in a green room with Hugh Grant, not the actor, but the president or CEO of Monsanto. And spontaneously and in the moment, Ruffalo spoke to him. And he said, you know, people don't go around complaining about companies, just to kill time or because they have nothing else to do. They're doing it because the companies aren't doing things that are good. And just that simple statement, you know, people don't go around, you know, kind of organizing. People don't go around trying to prevent trade deals from passing, you know, just because they have nothing better to do. It's really because these things are very egregious. And so it was just such a common sense way of looking at it. And, of course, that's why we're here doing this, you know, and all that kind of work. It's not because, we're not getting rich off of it. And it's like, you know, we wouldn't be doing it if these things weren't a problem. And, you know, we have to document that it is a problem, which you have done so brilliantly in the essay and everything, but and all throughout your work. But, I'm interested, too, in this light, in the risks that you mentioned earlier that the people who have leaked these contents have taken, you know, to make this information known. I mean, this is in the opposite end. Far from being denied or in denial or confused, there are people who are very clear, who are very close to the information, and who really took tremendous risks. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I think we all know of what happened to what's his name? Chelsea
Manning.
The person who, yeah, Chelsea Manning.
Manning. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, facing decades in prison and solitary confinement. That was the military justice system, which might be a bit more harsh. in these circumstances, but no, people can be criminally prosecuted, their careers can be ruined, they can be publicly defamed for leaking these documents. Security services are all over them. And one thing that is interesting to note is the National Security Agency, you know, the organization that taps phones and email conversations around the globe, and you know, has even monitored German Chancellor Eric Merkel's private conversations. They are the National Security Agency's third most important client after the CIA, the Department of Defense, is the U.S. Trade Representative's Office.
Wow.
So that was revealed in a leak also.
Wow.
And you have to wonder why a small group of people who actually work in the White House as presidential staff are using NSA, wiretapping and electronic surveillance more than everybody except their our top military and intelligence officials. And apparently there's massive surveillance conducted on behalf of the U.S. Trade Representative. That I think that's a concern.
Yeah.
I understand that there may be a noble motive for intrusive surveillance of related to terrorist threats, mass murder and so forth, but monitoring people who are opposed to a provision in a trade agreement that was written by Monsanto, the people who are exposing that or concerned about it may be surveilled. Now, of course, there are few limits on the NSA's surveillance of people in the United States, but it's well known that the British in particular monitor people in the United States. And, of course, if I have communications with my colleagues in Europe or with the writers at Le Monde, then those people, Friends of the Office of Friends of the Earth Europe or the offices of Le Monde in Paris, can be surveilled by the NSA, and of course, if they're having a conversation with me, I'm indirectly surveilled. So, and this again is a pretty hard to get your head around, and the immediate reaction is to deny that it could be that bad. But I think it really illustrates how things have gotten totally out of control in the making of international trade policy. And it shows you a lot
really
about
disturbing.
The mindset of the U.S. Trade Representative's office, that they see NSA surveillance as a very legitimate activity in connection with trade policy.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. That is really incredible. Well, on that note,
and the New York Times, I believe, was the one who exposed that. So this isn't, this isn't just stuff I got on the net.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. It's been a very informative and also a very reflective, show today. And I thank you for coming on the show again and for all the work you're doing. And, it's great to have this conversation, and I hope it's helpful to you listeners, too. Talk to people. Make the information known. Be involved. So this is closing up this week's edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, every Wednesday, on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay active, step up, and be well, everybody.